The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Back in 1995, I had the opportunity to interview a writer who lived in our region, who had built quite a reputation writing about early Ohio history. It's the only time I was ever able to interview Alan W. Eckert. He came out to see me in 1995 to talk about a book that was part of his series called The Winning of America. And the book was That Dark and Bloody River. Here's Alan Eckert on the Best of the Book Nook. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Afternoon Excursions Book Nook. I've been joined by my special guest, Alan Eckert, who has a new book out called That Dark and Bloody River, Chronicles of the Ohio River Valley. Good afternoon.
Hello. Good to be here.
You have written an incredible number of books, and this latest one is quite a book. Tell us about it.
Well, it's really the story of a river and the story of man's effort to control the river and to control the river valley. The story here picks up with the Ohio River during the first known human habitation, which was about 700 A.D., I'm sure there was probably habitation before that, but we can't pinpoint it. And carries it down through the years, especially into the American Revolutionary period, when the revolution was flaring in the East, and on the frontier, the Ohio River was the frontier, and a bitter fight was going on for control of the river and control of the Ohio country.
Having just finished the book last night, it's really an apt title.
Well, thank you.
This was a very bloody...
It was, indeed.
...couple of hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
When you did your research, did you, go to courthouses or...
Oh, yeah. Courthouses, and especially special library collections. There are a number of them that are extremely good. The Huntington Library in California, the Newberry Library in Chicago, the Clements Library up at Ann Arbor at University of Michigan. But the one I think I probably used the most was the historical collection of the Wisconsin Historical Society in Madison. Their archives have just an abundance of wonderful material about the formation period of the United States east of the Mississippi. And this is mostly handwritten original documents, holographic documents from the very time, from the hands of the participants. So it's really a wealth of material. The problem is, even though there are probably 2 or 3 million pages of material there, it's all handwritten and none of it's indexed. So you have to wade your way through it, and it's very difficult at times.
We were chatting before we went on the air about how a lot of the work on this book was done previously for another work, which
right.
You ended up editing out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was when I was first doing my Winning of America series, the first volume of which was called The Frontiersman. Many of the listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with that book. Excuse me. And my editors had said that they wanted to limit me on the contract to 250,000 words, which is a pretty fat book. And I started doing the work, and by the time I finished the first draft of the manuscript, I had close to 900,000 words. And, of course, they were tearing their hair out, and there was no way they could publish a book that size. The cost alone would be prohibitive. So they said, cut it down just as much as you can. So I worked at cutting it down, and I did finally get it down to about 350, which is where each of the volumes stands now, at about 350,000 words. But in the process of cutting down The Frontiersman, I had to cut a great deal of material out that I really hated to lose because it was wonderful material. It was material that covered the lives and activities of the Wetzel family, the Zanes in Wheeling area, the Brady family, who were the Rangers along the frontier. Anyway, all these families were cut out. Not that they were meant to be neglected, but there was simply something had to go, and they were expendable for that particular book. But I always kept the material, and I thought, one day I'll get back to it. One day I'll use that material. Because people would say, gee, how could you write a book like The Frontiersman and those that followed it and never mention the Wetzels? Well, that's true. It's very difficult. And so now they have their just place in my books.
There's just so much information. You can only put so much into a book. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have seen your works performed on stage. Can you tell us about how that's happened?
Well, the Tecumseh drama has been extant now for it will be going into its 24th year next year. And so it's been a very long time. Over a million people have seen it, and it's very popular. It runs each year from about the second week of June or the third week of June until the first week of September. And it employs a very large cast, usually between 70 and 100 actors, of which the principal roles are all equity actors. This is no amateur production. This is a very, very important and very powerful production. And it's noted for being an actor's drama rather than, as most outdoor dramas are, a pageant. This is not a musical pageant by any means. This is a very, very active and very powerful drama.
And this area that we're in right now, Greene County, this was Tecumseh's stomping grounds.
Oh, it was. It was where he was born. He was born, actually, on the grounds of what is now the Fish and Wildlife Division 5 headquarters, where there were a couple of big springs, and now those springs have been turned into rearing ponds for fish. But that's where he was born, and that was within two arrow flights of where the big village of Chilagatha, which we always pronounced Chillicothe, was located.
And straddling 68 now.
Yeah, right. It was on 68, right where Massey's Creek and the Little Miami River came together there. And, in fact, there's, unfortunately, a motel there now called the Tecumseh Motel. But in front of the motel, there are also a number of plaques that commemorate the spot of Tecumseh's birth and where Simon Kenton and Boone and others ran the gauntlet and so on.
And that's the old town.
Yeah, this was
an
enormous Indian town. This was a Shawnee town, and at one time it was said to have over 15,000 residents. So it was a big town.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
How did you make the switch from journalism to writing books?
Well, it wasn't difficult. I'd been writing all my life. I don't remember a time when I wasn't writing. People say, gee, how old were you when you started to write? I really don't know, because I don't remember a time when I wasn't. But I think what they mean is, when did you start selling? And that was a long time in coming. And it was, I guess, when I was in high school that I realized that people were really out there making money writing. And writing, to me, is what I wanted to do more than anything else. So I began writing very seriously and very earnestly and sending out a lot of material to different periodicals and other publications, and consistently getting rejection slips. And I was actually, without realizing it, going through a form of apprenticeship, but with no one to teach me. It was a hit-or-miss type of thing, a do-or-die, a learn-by-your-own-mistakes type of thing. And I kept sending things out. 12 years I sent things out without a sale. And finally, I made my first sale after 1,147 rejection slips.
Whoa.
Yeah. A long time.
That's incredible.
But then I began to realize, I analyzed my own work, and I began to realize why what I was writing wasn't selling. It wasn't the fault of editors not noticing good stuff when they saw it or anything else like that. It was I was not doing it correctly. And once I found the key of doing it correctly, I went back to almost everything I'd written previously and rewrote it and had no trouble selling it. And so everything was fine from that point on.
Is that a secret?
What I did was, what I had been doing is what most unpublished writers do. They write for themselves. They write to please themselves and to please their friends. And in doing so, they're not writing for the general public. And when you've got to study your market. Now, in those days, there were a lot more periodicals, monthly magazines on the stands. There were magazines like Look and Life and Saturday Evening Post and Red Book and Blue Book and all these, and they all wanted material. And so I would just write my stories, whatever they were, short stories or articles or poetry or whatever, and send it in. And sure enough, it had come back with a rejection slip. And it took me a long time before I really began to analyze what was in these magazines I was sending to. Why wasn't my material being accepted? And what I found out after this self-examination was that I needed to slant my material. And to me, the word slant always meant compromise your work. Do it the way an editor wants you to do it, not the way you want to do it. Well, that wasn't right. You have to slant it toward the readership of that particular publication. So once I discovered that and began to slant it toward that readership, then I had no problem at all. And I went back to several of the pieces that I did, magazine pieces, and maybe sold them 4, 5, 6, 7 times by slanting them to different readerships and selling them to different magazines.
How will this piece appeal to this type of reader?
This book, you mean?
I guess you were thinking to yourself, if I'm going to put this in the Saturday Evening Post,
exactly. Right.
What do their readers want?
Yeah, what is their readership like? What do they want? What are they looking for? And so on. And once you bear that in mind and start writing toward an audience instead of writing toward yourself, then you begin making it pay off.
My guest is Alan W. Eckert, his new book, That Dark and Bloody River. And it talks about this area, folks, tremendous detail, almost a microscopic technique. You just don't leave anything out. How did you get this technique where you look at the most minute details?
Well, that's part of, you know, when I was young, I really didn't like history very much. In fact, when I went to high school, history was one of my least favorite subjects. And the problem was the books were very uninspiring. The teachers were very uninspiring. And it was kind of a learn the dates type of thing and very dull and very dry. And when I began writing for the magazines and so on, there were a number of magazines out there that were historical magazines, American History Magazine, Traditions, and a number of others. And to do things for them, I began haunting libraries and going back into old documents and finding interesting things that had not been published and turning them into articles or anecdotal material or whatever. And as I was doing so, I tried to bring life and verve to them and bring them a sense of immediacy. And when I began doing my books, the historical books, I thought the way history should be presented to the people is to make it really live, to make it sing, to make it read like a novel, to have all the novel techniques about it, but yet to have the veracity of history, so that even though it was reading like a novel, you could bank on the veracity of everything it said, that these things really did happen and these conversations took place and so on. And so in using this technique and going into great depth about the individuals, building their character and so on, going into great depth about the topography and where places were located and so on, and relating them to present day points of interest and so on. This all came together in the type of format that I've worked out.
So you get the history, you do the research, and then to make it more interesting, you do just the slightest bit of embellishment to make it read more like a novel.
I wouldn't call it an embellishment, because there you begin to think, well, he's added stuff that's not true. What I do, especially in the matter, now when these books first came out, the academic people were not very pleased with it, simply because they felt that I was creating dialogue and changing history, embellishing history, and I wasn't. They were not accustomed to the fact that someone could go into the historical documents and find this kind of stuff, not written as dialogue, but bring it back into a dialogue form. Because people would write in their diaries, oh, things like, on the trail today I met Simon Kenton, and he told me that he had been out with his friend Jake Drennan, and Jake Drennan got killed, and so on. Well, when I show the actual meeting of Simon Kenton and this diarist, then I have that conversation took place. It's what they said. Mm-hmm. So it's not made up. It's just brought back. It's reconstituted into a form of dialogue, and this is what brings life and verve to it.
I guess I didn't mean embellishment as making up anything. The book is extensively footnoted and annotated.
Yes.
It's just incredible.
Right.
When I first got the book, I opened it up and I said, uh-oh, this is a long one. But it was a very smooth read for me. I was able to follow all the different plot lines that were converging. And I never realized that in 1795 that the tide really turned with the Battle of Fallen Timbers and General Anthony Wayne. Can you tell our audience about
that? Well, it was in 94, actually, that the battle took place. The treaty was signed in 95. And, yes, everything that had happened in the past from the earliest of the Indian contact, which was right after the French and Indian War in the Ohio country, up until that point, it was a terrible clash of cultures, of the culture and the whites wanting to move in and take the land, the Indians wanting to preserve the lands that were their hereditary lands. And so this struggle went on and on. There were some very, very severe fights, including some that one, in fact, was the worst defeat the Americans ever had at the hands of the Indians, which was the St. Clair's defeat, in which over 600 soldiers were killed in that battle. Anyway, this all came to the end when Anthony Wayne was made the commanding general of the American forces in the West. And he was determined he was going to beat the Indians, and he met them in battle at Fallen Timbers, which was up pretty close to Toledo. And this is where they had their battle. It was just a one-day battle, but he defeated them soundly, and by then a great deal of the heart of the Indians had gone out. They had lost so much. They had been driven back so much. They were having such a hard time even surviving, much less fighting, that at that point they gave in and they signed the treaties. And within not many years after that, they were all moved westward.
As I read the book, the deluge of whites coming in and filing claims on this virgin territory, it was almost obscene.
Oh, it was.
Because they have this concept that nobody owned this land until they claimed it, and they totally disregarded the natural inhabitants.
Right. And the Indians did not have anything in their culture that was comparable to owning land. It was a concept they didn't understand. Nobody owned land. The land was given to all men by Manitou, the great god, and it was for all men to use equally and wisely and well, to use the resources in a safe and sane way and replenish them and so on. And this is what they did. And to see the whites come in as they did and destroy these resources and make it so that they could not replenish themselves, this was so foreign to them and so desecratory that they just couldn't believe this was happening.
And you have big names like George Washington, Ben Franklin. Yeah. And
George Washington, we talk about him, this is our great white father, the father of our country and all that. But he was, he advocated genocide of the tribes, and so did Thomas Jefferson. They laid this out in their papers, advocating genocide, steps that could be taken to force the Indians to capitulate, and if they didn't capitulate, to destroy them and to help make them help destroy themselves. Very elaborate plans.
As I read the book, I kept thinking how wonderful it would be to see this beautiful land the way they saw it, and on the other hand, I would be absolutely terrified to live in a society like they had, where the capacity for violence was there constantly.
This capacity for violence was usually against their very, very worst enemies. And this was not something that went on in everyday life by any means. So we hear of the severe Indian atrocities and so on, and yet in the research I've done, which has been extensive over these past more than three decades, I have found that in almost every case, the worst Indian atrocities were committed in direct retaliation for white atrocities perpetrated against them that were never written up, that were never discussed, or that were barely mentioned in the historical pages. And that was part of the trouble with our historical books. They were very nationalistic, they were very biased, and very prejudiced against the Indians. So you couldn't get a true picture of what had really occurred. And I didn't want to editorialize about the Indians or about the whites or anything else or point fingers and say who was at fault. To me, the important thing was to tell the facts as nearly and as deeply and as truly as I could find the facts, state them as they occurred, and let the reader draw his own judgment as to who was at fault or who wasn't and so on.
I guess when I was referring to violence, I was referring to everybody.
Oh, sure.
Not just Native Americans. I was talking about the settlers, everybody.
Yeah, it was a violent time, all right.
There's lots no of liquor and lots of weapons.
And lots of blood.
Yeah. Just amazing. Yeah. You currently reside in Belle Fountain. Is this a good place for you to live?
Well, Belle Fountain was one of the site of one of the principal Shawnee towns, Blue Jackets Town, it was called in the early days. And it's a very beautiful area. It's the highest point in elevation in the state of Ohio. And it's the site of just some beautiful rolling country. Now, right here at Yellow Springs, you have Clifton Gorge running through the area. And that played a very important part in the Shawnee history, too, because there were silver mines there where the Shawnees mined the silver, and they had a great abundance of silver. These mines have never been found again once the Shawnees abandoned them and closed them. There have been a number of attempts to find them. Geologists have come in and said, well, you know, this land is not the type of land that produces silver ore, and yet you can go down in Clifton Gorge and take some rock samples, and you've got trace silver in them. So it's there somewhere, and nobody has really found it. But the whole country here throughout central and western and south central Ohio is filled with a great deal of lore and history.
What can you tell us about Yellow Springs specifically? Was there activity in that area?
There was not a village here per se. The closest village to this area here, there was one 5 miles directly west of Springfield, right on the Mad River. This was where the John Bryan State Park is located now, or William Clark State Park, rather, and George Rogers Clark State Park.
Uh-huh.
I knew I'd get it okay. Right eventually. And this is where one of the battles was fought that they took part in, and the Shawnees were defeated there and abandoned their village and moved on. But that was a little to the north of Yellow Springs, and Chilagatha was a little bit to the south. So the Route 68 out here that runs right through Yellow Springs was the Warrior Trail. And they used to take that Warrior Trail. It ran all the way down, across the river near Ripley, Ohio, over to Maysville, and down to the Blue Licks area, which is one of their big hunting areas. So that Warrior Trail played a very important part, and it continued all the way down into Tennessee. And it's the road they used to take when they would go on their excursions against the Cherokees and the Creeks.
I like that, excursions. Sounds like a vacation. My guest is Alan W. Eckert, and his new book is That Dark and Bloody River. You have been nominated for the Pulitzer 6 different times.
Yeah, always a bridesmaid.
Doris Kearns Goodwin was on the program last month. She won it in history this past year. Was she one of your competitors?
In history, yeah, she was. Not this last time. My history of Tecumseh came out in 92.
Okay.
So we were not competing, but she evidently wrote a very good book.
Well, she had several before that, too,
right.
And I know they have some pretty strict folks overseeing the whole process, but we sure wish you luck on that seventh nomination. Which
if and when.
I'm sure it's in there somewhere. Can you tell us how long it took you to put this whole book together?
Well, this one it would be kind of misleading because so much of this material was done very early. And then as I began doing this, it was over a period of many years that a lot of the information was gathered. So in essence, this thing took 35 years of research, but that's ridiculous. Most of the Winning of America books, which are in the same line, that when I would bear down and really home in on the research, would take anywhere from 2 to 4, 4.5 years of research. The Frontiersman, which was first, took 7 years, but that was longer because it was the first one, and the research with the others tended to become cumulative. But I'd say an average figure of 3 to 3.5 years would be about right for the research. Then when all the research is done and the actual writing starts, it's a process that takes about 9 months for me to put one of them to bed finally.
What's next for you?
A totally different type of book. I'm doing a book called The World of Opals. And this is about the gemstone.
Oh, really?
And it will tell you, it'll be the definitive work on opals. There's never been one written. It'll tell where opals are found throughout the world, how they're mined, how they're cut and polished for gemstones, what makes opals so different from all other gemstones, why they're so very valuable, and so on. Opals now are competing with diamonds as the number one gemstone in value. Good opals now are selling upwards of $12,000 per carat. So they're a very interesting stone. And I've been doing a lot of research. I just came back from spending a month in Australia researching their opal mines over there. And it was a very interesting trip.
Why opals? Have you been an opal person for a while?
No, not really. I became interested in opals myself about 1989 and have become very interested ever since. For one thing, there are no two opals that are alike. They are all totally different. Yet you can look at an opal and say this came from this particular mine or this particular area and be exactly right. That's how distinctive they are to a particular area. And yet individually they differ from one another so totally. And they constantly change their fragile stone to work with in cutting and polishing. But the beauty that's inherent in them is just phenomenal. When you've seen a diamond, you've seen almost every diamond, or a sapphire, or a ruby, or an emerald. But when you've seen an opal, the next opal is so different that there's no comparison whatsoever. So all these opals are very, very different and very beautiful.
Are they metamorphic stones?
Yeah, well, they're sedimentary stones primarily, and they're formed usually through electrolysis in the volcanic ash.
Oh, wow. So you only find those in certain places in the world.
Yeah, they're usually associated with volcanic activity, even when they're sedimentary opals.
I see. You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And Alan Eckert was my guest, his only appearance on the program back in 1995 to talk about his book, That Dark and Bloody River. He was an amazing guy, and he had a brilliant mind. Alan Eckert was born on January 30th, 1931, and died on July 7th, 2011. He wrote a lot of books. He was nominated numerous times for the Pulitzer Prize, and he won an Emmy Award. Did you know that he won an Emmy Award? It was for the writing that he did for the program Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. He wrote more than 225 episodes of the program. He was a man of many talents. He was also a runner-up for the Newbery Medal for his children's novel Incident at Hawks Hill. And it was really great to talk to him back in 1995. And I hope some of you can come to Springfield on Saturday, April 28th for the Clark County Public Library's Springfield Writes Author Fair at the library. I will be giving a speech at 11 o'clock in the main library Geyer room in Springfield. I'll be talking about authors I have known. That's Saturday, April 28th at 11 a.m. I hope to see you there. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.